Call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. Welcome, everyone. Today we have only one item on the agenda, and that's a public hearing on Senate Bill 496. So I will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 496. Paul.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 496 was drafted at the request of the committee. And it does a couple of things. In Section 1 of the bill, it deletes the 10% diversion of Education Stability Fund revenue into the Oregon Growth Account. And then in the next section, Section 2, it reinstates that 10% diversion and effective July 1, 2011. So what it amounts to is a two-year suspension of the 10% diversion of Education Stability Fund dollars into the Oregon Growth Account. Section 6 of the bill at the end also does require a report from the Treasurer to the legislature by February 1 of 2011 to summarize the performance of the Oregon Growth Account, to recommend whether the version of funds should be restored, and also to estimate the expected benefits of restoring all or part of the diversion. So the bill, in other words, is a temporary suspension of the two-year allocation of Education Stability Fund dollars into the Oregon Growth Account. I do have some background information for you. And the first piece is in terms of the dollar amounts we're looking at, the lottery, of course, remember the lottery forecast was down considerably with the March release. And it's a little tricky looking at the lottery statement now because we're still projected to hit the 5% cap toward the end of 2009-11. But if you kind of abstract from that and assume that there'll probably be withdrawals that will push us below that, the 18% of estimated lottery earnings is $203 million. So if you take 10% of that under current law without this bill, about $20.3 million would go into the Oregon Growth Account over that two-year period. So that's the difference. That's what the impact of this bill would be in terms of the dollar amounts. In terms of the Oregon Growth Account itself, and we have the Treasurer here to explain more of that to you, I did copy off on the back of your draft staff measure summary, a chart that the Treasury had given us. As you recall, those on the committee in February approved a bill, House Bill 3620, and this was the background information for that. And you can kind of see how the growth account fits in. The dollars flow 18% from lottery into the Education Stability Fund, and the growth account is a sub-account of the Stability Fund. And that's the 10% that flows into the growth account. Another issue to look at is the earnings, declared earnings, as they're called in statute, are to flow into the Oregon Commercialized Research Fund. And that was actually recommended by our previous treasurer to look at that fund for possible for non-viability, for changing that part of the statute. This bill does not do that, however. The other thing I would point out is House Bill 3620, which was at the request of the House Revenue Committee in February, required a report from then Treasurer Edwards, and that report was issued on January 2nd of this year, and it addresses some of the questions about the Oregon Growth Account, about its performance, about venture capital returns in general, about the expected time horizon on earnings from those funds. It also points out that this commercialized research fund no longer has a purpose, and a return of earnings directly back to Education Stability Fund would be a more appropriate use. So that's actually a recommendation from that report. So that's for your background in considering Senate Bill 496.
Thank you very much, and we are honored today by the presence of our esteemed State Treasurer, Mr. Ben Westland, former member of this body. Welcome, Mr. Westland. Come on up with whoever you want to bring.
Thank you. Madam Chair, if I could invite Mike Mueller, Deputy of our Investment Division.
Please do.
handles much of this, I would appreciate that. For the record, my name is Treasurer Ben Westland, and I very much appreciate, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the opportunity to be here today to testify on something I feel deeply and passionate about that, in my opinion, and I believe the numbers bear this out, has unquestionable value to the long-term interests of the state of Oregon and the quality of life of all Oregonians. Let me begin by saying that today we have formally announced for the first time in the Oregon growth accounts history, the treasurer has declared earnings in the amount of $18 million. We feel that under these dire economic circumstances and the difficult decisions, draconian decisions, that each and every one of you are going to have to make, this is an appropriate reinvestment in Oregon. These are, let me be clear, these are earnings and do not exceed the total amount of capital committed from the Oregon growth account. These are individual funds that have performed well, companies that have performed well. These are true earnings, but they do not reflect a total recapture of capital invested from the inception of this program. One of the things that I think is important to keep in mind as we go forward, that these earnings, for the most part, represent investments the Oregon growth account made in 99 and 2000, which shows very clearly that the nature of this investing is long-term and that these investments are illiquid until returns are made or the company, and we have some of these, regrettably, goes the way of the dinosaur. This is, in essence, venture capital, a venture capital mode of investing. And so, again, these are long-term illiquid investments, and this $18 million represents earnings from investments we made in 99 and 2000. So as we go forward, it's important to keep the investment flow going. We have many companies, on the verge of profitability, employing, that today currently have an aggregate annual wage of $83 million of living wage jobs per year. That's approximately 1,300 jobs, 1,345 to be precise. This is in and of itself, during these times when a job is not just a job, it's a job, is ever more critical to Oregon's future. So we are very pleased to be in front of this committee to announce publicly for the first time our commitment to the state's economic circumstances and the declaration of $18 million worth of earnings. If I could comment briefly on the bill, I obviously have read it. I know what it does, and I will tell you there is actually one thing I like about the bill. It's relating to clause.
That's good. Because we always like to hear positive feedback.
Exactly. Let me spend most of my time on that. One thing I think we're all in agreement on is the disposition of these funds needs to go back to the Education Stability Fund and not to the Commercialization Fund. So with your relating to clause, Madam Chairman, that's an easy fix. In fact, if you could just redline the whole rest of the bill and put in that vital necessary change, you will have done your job.
So obviously we have concerns over the capping or elimination of the funds for any period of time. Again, I believe these dollars are unique. It's really the only fund that Oregon has, that Oregon supports, that specifically requires these dollars to be invested in Oregon companies. All of these are Oregon companies employing Oregonians, and if a fund manager happens to be located out of state, you know, we require them to match the dollars that Oregon provides when they come back into state. The total capital flow created, and I'd have to ask Mike about this, of our $46 million invested is, round numbers, how much? It's an additional...
$121 million.
Could you identify yourself?
I'm sorry. Madam Chair, Mike Mueller. I'm the Deputy Chief Investment Officer at the Oregon State Treasury. $121 million in total capital has come to Oregon companies, even though the Oregon growth account component is only $46 million of that. So that's leveraging dollars from other investors that come from outside of the state, or they may come from within the state, but not from the Oregon growth account specifically.
Or to say that real simply, for every dollar we invest, we attract, you know, three additional dollars invested in Oregon companies.
And do you have any way of parsing out how many of those dollars would have come anyway, or whether they came because there was that core investment?
I believe it's fair if you put a screen on it of some percent, 20%, you know, would have happened anyway. I don't know. Maybe it's only 10. But unquestionably, the bulk of these dollars, you can discount that darn near any number you want. But at the end of the day, Oregon is far better off, far better capitalized than we would have been without this specific Invest in Oregon approach.
And, Madam Chair, I think you're going to hear testimony later from some folks that actually invest the money on behalf of the Oregon Growth Account that would probably be in a better position to answer that question in terms of how the capital that they provide through the OGA attracts additional investment.
Okay. And maybe you could just give us a couple of, for instances, of companies, Oregon companies, that have benefited from this investment. Do you have any right at hand? I should have told you, but I was going to ask this question before. But.
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to provide that. I don't have any off the top of my head that I'm willing to provide or can provide, but again, there's several in the back of the room that can. A lot of in the high tech sector, Cryptic, Well Partner. There are 67 in total, and I'd be happy to provide you the whole list.
Great, and we have that somewhere. I just thought maybe just a couple of examples.
Sure.
And we can ask subsequent witnesses to do that. Okay, anything else before I open it to questions?
Just, we'd be happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Questions from the committee. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe start my question, if I could. If you look at the Education Stability Fund, how would you characterize those investments by on a scale of risk to less risky? High risk, low risk, the funds that are invested today, how would you characterize those?
Total fund. I would bifurcate and describe differently the category of risk between the bulk of the Education Stability Fund, which would, you know, fall into the conservative or core conservative type of investment. The distinction I would make is obviously the great exception to that rule is the Oregon Growth Account, which would fall into, you know, high risk, high reward classification. This is, in simplest terms, venture capital investing, and I think that's an appropriate mix because we functionally take, you know, 1.8% of lottery proceeds, 10% into the Oregon Growth Account. So you've got a 90-10 split, and obviously the whole idea, and I have no background, even though I think we were all here when this occurred, the commercialization fund was created. I think if these funds accrue back to the Education Stability Fund, that's a very appropriate balance, because as time goes on, the Oregon Growth Account will be creating more jobs, more taxes, more income taxes, more property taxes, more payroll taxes, more workers' compensation proceeds for other purposes in the state, as well as providing, you know, increasing earnings back to the Education Stability Fund. We've been doing this long enough. There's a long enough track record that this is a proven model. Sure, you're going to have up years, you're going to have down years. And if I can, as an aside, we are in what's classically described as a vintage investing period. Some of the greatest returns in investment portfolios, you know, are found in investments in these critical, difficult times. So the short answer to your question is 90-10.
Do you have a sense of how the returns would compare, Madam Chair, between the 90 and between the 10?
I don't specifically know the exact performance figures on the 90, but again, those are safer. They are fall more into the category of short-term money market bond fund returns. So, yeah, I'm going to make a best guess at 3-4% a year. If you target, you kind of wheeled out over the 10 plus years we've been doing this. You look at our return, you know, our earnings to date. It's about 4% a year, with jobs created, with equity in companies that are doing well, and as time accrued, we're just now starting to, you know, be able to reap some of the benefits of this. It takes time. These are long-term, illiquid investments, and I see that the earnings flow increasing as we go forward. I will tell you, there was a gap in funding in 01 that will create a lag in those, and then a reduced funding in 03. I also tell you that in 02, a similar action as is proposed in the bill, the temporary suspension of the lottery fund proceeds was proposed and passed, but the legislature felt so strongly about the Oregon Growth Account, they gave a one-time general fund appropriation. So the legislature has seen value in this long-term. It's important to keep, you know, the lottery flow coming.
Madam Chair, let me just make a comment. I can very much appreciate what these funds could do, but there's a disconnect here for me in that stability funds implies liquidity, because you never know when you're needing to access those funds. And to take 10% of that stream of money and to put it into illiquid assets is just a total disconnect with stability. Now, if you want to pull monies off somewhere else and put it in, but with respect to education stability, and that's the problem that I have, and it's one that I think the direction we're going is not consistent with stability for education.
Madam Chair, Senator Moore, I understand the framing of that concern. I don't fundamentally disagree with it. On the other hand, I think there is an argument to be made that in a savings account, you know, based on a certain lower level, obviously in this case 10%, that there is a vehicle granted. Long-term, high-risk, high-reward, there is a modeling that allows a savings account, in this case education, to participate and benefit from what is now becoming a proven track record of investment. Yin and yang. I understand, sir.
Thank you.
But to follow up that point, there's no real reason why it would have to be located within this stability fund. I mean, if you had a funding stream, you could put it almost anywhere. Isn't that correct?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Yep, that answers my question.
Okay. Senator Hess, did you have a question? Senator Rosenbaum?
Madam Chair, I don't have a question now, but I'm wondering if we can get these witnesses back if we have questions after we've heard from others.
Okay. I think at least Michael will be able to stay, right, for the whole hearing.
Sure. Be happy to.
Is that adequate?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Well, and I've actually checked my schedule, and I can be close, let me put it that way.
Okay.
Well, and, of course, fully accessible by this committee.
Yes, and I have your cell phone number, so we're in good shape. Okay. Thank you very much.
If I could just close, Madam Chair, in thanking you for the opportunity to testify, I just want to testify strongly in favor of the bills relating to clause. I just think that's absolutely imperative. I'm glad this bill's come forward. All right. Thank you, ma'am.
Well, I think I can speak for the committee. We do like the amendment that you proposed. At least the chair does. Okay. Let's see. Normally, I'd like to start off with proponents, so I'm going to start off with Chuck Sheketoff. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Chuck Sheketoff, Executive Director of the Oregon Center for Public Policy. I'm not good on multiple choice tests, so I put that I support it, but I do have some amendments to suggest. So. When we were analyzing the rainy day fund in the fall of 2007 that the 2007 legislature had enacted, we were trying to figure out, well, how much money is it getting from, does it have, and how much money does the Education Stability Fund have? We noticed different numbers from Legislative Revenue Office than from Department of Administrative Services. And that didn't make sense. And we figured out the reason was that one of the offices was taking out of the money going to the Education Stability Fund the 10% that goes to the Oregon Growth Account. And they were, and neither office was right or wrong, it was they were recognizing that that money, as Senator Morse expressed concern, is tied up and isn't liquid and isn't available to the Education Stability Fund and looking at its health. And so we've since recommended that what should happen is the voters passed a constitutional amendment that said 18% of lottery funds go to the Education Stability Fund. The legislature, and in the haste of putting together the Education Stability Fund in 2002, during that fiscal crisis, and in piecing it together from the old endowment fund, kept in that growth account. It should not have done that. That was a mistake. I think it's a lot of what you do is correcting prior legislative mistakes. And so what's happening is it's tying up money, as Senator Morris has alluded to, and it's denying the Education Stability Fund the full 18%. It's only getting 16.2. And the money from the Oregon Growth Account, there's one statute, ORS 348.702 says the earnings from the Oregon Growth Account shall accrue to the Education Stability Fund. There's another statute, ORS 348.696, which says no, the earnings go to the Commercialized Research Fund. So it's inconsistent. And so what we believe ought to happen is, and I've never seen an attorney general opinion, nor has probably one that's never been asked, is it even appropriate, is that statute constitutional that you're diverting money and tying it up that the voters said needed to go to the Education Stability Fund? It's sort of an earmark, frankly. And we believe that the Education Stability Fund should get the full 18% that you asked the voters to approve, and that the Education Stability Fund can get its effectively 1.8% of lottery money, but directly from the lottery. And so actually a bill was read for the first time today in the House, House Bill 2938, which does that. It takes the Oregon Growth Account out, makes it so it's not a sub-account of the Education Stability Fund, and it gives it 1.8% of lottery money, so that the Education Stability Fund gets the full 18%. Now, whether the Oregon Growth Account should the dedicating its earnings to the commercialization fund or the education stability fund is a separate story, and I think it's a separate decision, and it's in a different context once it's not within the education stability fund. But it should be taken out of there. It'd be its own account with its own funding stream from the lottery. So the education stability fund should be fully paid. The bill, House Bill 2938, does not require the education stability fund to be paid back for all the money it hasn't received over the years. But it does clean it up so that the growth account has to stand on its own, and the decisions about where that money goes to, whether it goes to the commercialized research or other high-risk venture-type investments, or whether it goes to education or just free for what, you know, what the treasurer announced today, the $18 million. I mean, he's rightly, I think, said it's declared some earnings, and he wrote the co-chairs, but they can't just sort of spend it in an appropriations bill like you've been considering on the other funds around the general fund, because it's not in the general fund. It's in the, it by statute goes to the commercialized research fund. So we think it should clean it up and give the growth account direct lottery money, make sure that the education stability fund gets its full 18%, and clean that up. And that's what the House version would do, which you could substitute into yours.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Thank you. So you you would have no objection to the fund existing. I presume you'd have no objection if it were a standalone fund to having the earnings go to one of the rainy day funds.
No, absolutely not. I think that'd be great. I mean, I think having those funds get the earnings, and I think that's probably a better move than putting them into more high-risk investments and tying it up that way. At some point, the earnings should be declared like they were today, and they should go into today's need versus going into these venture funds, which have, as you heard, long payback periods if they do pay back. And so having a go to education is great, and that's how it was promoted over the years. you'd even hear it. It's dedicated to the Education Stability Fund. No, it isn't. It's dedicated to the Commercialized Research Fund. It's even been sort of misrepresented because of the conflict in the statutes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's see. We have someone who would like to comment from Department of Justice on what we just heard. I think we might just do that for continuity. Come on up.
Madam Chair, Stephen Marlowe is my name. I'm Assistant Attorney General in the Tax and Finance section, and I represent the Oregon Growth Account. I was unaware of this new bill, but I simply wanted to state, connect a few dots, which I think would help understand, and if the previous gentleman would like to comment, then perhaps we can clarify some things.
Chuck, why don't you come on back while he talks?
Yeah,
I could have
you.
Waited, but I think it's better just to clarify it now.
Yeah. I think I think the correct statements were that 18% of lottery proceeds go to the Education Stability Fund, and then 10% go to the Oregon Growth Account. On the flip side of the agenda for today, there was this chart which shows all those things, and so the arrow then of what comes out of the Oregon Growth Account shows 100% of declared earnings going to the Oregon Commercialized Research Fund. Sorry.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
We all have the chart in front of us.
Okay. So then, in the statute, it says, okay, so what's the Commercialized Research Fund then supposed to do with those earnings? Any monies received from the Education Stability Fund are deposited into the Research Fund pursuant to the statute that he cited there, the 696, shall be placed in a separate account within the Commercialized Research Fund and may be used by the Council only for public education. So the concept of using these funds in the Education Stability Fund for education was continued, and so and I'm assuming you know the previous drafters here from Legislative Council were thinking exactly of the concept there, that the money was somehow going to was going to escape educational purposes, so they built that into the statute. That so I think the funds are still used for education even when they are declared earnings and released from the Oregon Growth Account.
Okay, that's useful to know.
Okay. The second point I just wanted to make, in which case I imagine Legislative Council will need to be considering, can the Oregon Growth Account be separated from the Education Stability Fund? The Oregon Growth Account has stock. It owns stock, and there's a constitutional prohibition on the ownership of stock. However, under Article 15, Section 4 of the Constitution, Section 4 on the regulation of lotteries and the use of the proceeds from the state lottery, there is specifically carved out the exclusion from the ownership of stock for the Education Stability Fund.
Oh, okay.
So for the Oregon Growth Account to be then separated from the Education Stability Fund, it might lose that exclusion which now applies, and which also, by the way, the Oregon Resource Technology and Development sub-account, which is part of the Oregon Growth Account, as I understand, I wasn't here at the time, but was brought into the Oregon Growth Account because I believe it also owns stock, and so it needed to be brought in under this exclusion of owning stock and the prohibition against owning stock. So those two things, I believe, need some exclusion for the ownership of stock and on a going-forward basis.
This is starting to come back to me. Okay, so basically what you're saying is that if we did separate out, if we did try to do what Mr. Sheketoff would like us to do, and the Treasurer has no objection to, if we separated it out and had its own funding source, 1.8% or whatever from the lottery, that we would need a constitutional amendment to provide that fund with the same exclusion that the Stability Fund has. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Were you aware of that, Mr.?
I wasn't. I mean, when we asked for it to be drafted, with the way they drafted it was they put the growth account, the monies for it, first going to the Administrative Services Economic Development Fund, and then from there into the growth account. And, you know, maybe they missed that constitutional provision. Legislative Council can do that, but more often than not, when someone turns in a bill that says, and there's a constitutional problem, they catch it there.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's the problem, then you need to do another referral. I mean, the Education Stability Fund, you had to send to the voters twice to get it approved. And maybe you're now going to have to send it a third time.
No, we don't have to send the educational
stability. Right, the growth account. Maybe you have to send the
growth account.
Right.
We might, yeah.
You might have to.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for clearing that up. Appreciate
Madam Chair.
Senator Hess.
What about then this bill? I mean, are there constitutional problems with a repeal or a suspension?
I'm sorry.
Of the growth account?
Okay, which bill? The new bill this morning, or is it 496?
496.
Okay, so with 496?
Yeah.
And then what was, I'm sorry,
are,
Madam
are
Chair.
Are there constitutional issues because of what you just said a minute ago?
Oh, are there constitutional...
Bill or suspend?
Are there constitutional issues with suspending the funding? No. For the legislature, okay, the legislature has, pursuant to statute, allocated the 10% of the 18% to the Oregon Growth Account, so it can amend its statute and delete it, which is the way 496 is drafted, to simply delete it for 2 years, and then it comes back. And so it's simply deleting that portion of the statute which allocates 10% of the money that's going to the Education Stability Fund to the Oregon Growth Account.
So that is constitutional. Other questions? Thank you very much. Okie doke. Now we'll have Wayne Embry. And if everyone here is signed up separately, so you know who you are who are signed up. If anybody wants to come with each other, feel free. Yeah.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, thank you for the time today. I'm Wayne Embry. I'm managing partner of Reference Capital Management. We're a Tigard-based venture capital firm. I can actually answer some of the questions about the history of a lot of this. My start in the business began in the mid-'80s, managing one of the co-managers of the Oregon Resource and Technology Development Corporation and then Resource and Technology Development Fund. That was a pool of money created by the Assembly in 85 in response to the recession in the 80s to be more in tune with what the needs of entrepreneurial ventures were in Oregon at that time. That fund represented the first institutional money in 45 Oregon companies between 1986 and 1998. And some of those companies include AVI Biopharma, which came out of Oregon State University, Hillsboro-based FEI, which was based on work at Linfield College and Oregon Graduate Institute, and Radisys, which was one of the first spin-outs from Intel's campus here in Oregon, Portland-based division of WebMD, which is one of the major contributors to the medical informatics cluster that we have here in the state, Hood River-based Full Sail Brewing, whose development was one of the major and significant improvements to the old Diamond Fruit Packing facility, which is now one of the major draws in Hood River, and Bend-based Sutera, which was a spin-out of Bend Research, and one of the leading providers of biorational pesticides. In 2008, those companies, as well as some of our other Oregon-based investments, employed about 3,000 people, generated over $1 billion in revenues, and something on the order of $200 million in wages. So in addition to providing an exceptional return on investment to the funds created in the mid-80s, they've also continued to be dramatic employers and contributors to the general fund. One of the prize mementos we have from those investments is one of the early prototype graphics for the first label for Full Sail Brewing. And what we didn't realize at the time is while we thought it was a wonderful team and it was a great opportunity, we didn't realize it was going to become a foundation of a world-class industry based here that really drew upon assets and production components, you know, clean water, world-class hops and malted barley that was really pretty unique to the Oregon and the Northwest. I think everybody here is sympathetic to the challenges that the legislature and this committee have before them. And I know that companies like Full Sail and the Oregon Growth Account, you know, sort of converge at the issues that you're dealing with right now. And while you're facing these economic challenges, I would hope that you would also think about what the unintended consequences of some of the actions may be. And so instead of, you know, reducing the amount of money going to the Oregon Growth Account right now, I would actually encourage you to increase it, because we have an opportunity to be at the front edge of the next innovation wave that is appearing not only in this state but also across the country, and capitalize on that, which will put us in a good position for a fair amount of the stimulus package that's being developed not only by the state but also by the federal government. And so with that, thank you for your time and be happy to answer any questions.
It sounds like you've made some wise investment decisions, and you certainly made a good location decision to be located in my district, Tigard. Are any of these investments that you mentioned, do any of these involve funding from the Oregon Growth Account?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that all the original investment in these companies came from the lottery funds that were set aside by the 85 Assembly. And so it's the predecessor to the growth account, but it's the same philosophy, so direct investment into Oregon companies.
And what what kind of leverage was there at that time? Do you remember?
It's actually enormous. Historically, our leverage, because we're a very early-stage investor, our leverage is 10 to 12 to 1. So for every dollar we invest, there's at least another $12 coming from other investors.
And where does the public money fit in that?
In most of these cases, we were the first institutional investors. So there may have been some individual investors. There may have been government grants like the Small Business Innovation Research Program funding. But in every one of these cases, we were the first sort of institutional money that was coming in and helping structure an investment vehicle that would, you know, provide an equity-like return.
And you were using the state funds. I mean, there was some kind of approval process to get the state funds to you and then put you in charge of them.
Yes.
Okay, got it. Okay. And is that, as far as you know, is that pretty much the same framework? Are you seeing the same framework with the growth account that you had previously?
It's a bit different in the sense that we were the sole manager of those funds for 12 years. And then when the fairly long story, but in the 2000 timeframe, when that was all reorganized and became part of the Oregon Growth Account, they then began investing in a larger number of managers. And Bill Newman, to my right, can actually give you much more detail on that.
Okay. Other questions, Mr. Embry, before we move on? Thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Yes, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. My name is Bill Newman. I'm a managing director of Northwest Technology Ventures. We're a seed stage venture fund located in Portland, and we are a recipient of Oregon Growth Account funds. That means that the Oregon Growth Account is an investor in our fund and so participates in the returns that we generate with the investments we make. And thank you for allowing me to address you this afternoon. I'd like to provide some background and some color on some of the actual results we've obtained, and I can give you a couple of examples of companies too so you can get some sense as to the type of investments we make and the impact they have. I'm not going to comment on the prior conversation related to the proper home for the Oregon Growth Account, but I will give you some data and information that should indicate to you its significance and its value to the state of Oregon. So, as I mentioned, we are a seed stage venture fund. Our particular focus is we look for technologies that have been developed in Oregon's research institutions, and then we work with the institution, with the local entrepreneurial community, to spin those technologies out of the universities and the research laboratories and create companies that then reside in Oregon. And to date, we've invested in 16 different companies. 12 of these are indeed university and research-related companies. We provide the earliest stage of capital to allow those companies to get started to accomplish some of their initial business objectives, which will then position them to raise additional funds. So here's an example of some of the results we've been able to achieve to date. We've invested or committed to invest in those 16 companies a total of approximately $9.5 million. That has enabled those companies to make the necessary accomplishments to then go out and raise additional dollars. In fact, those companies have raised a total of $147 million, and much of that comes from out-of-state sources. They employ 220 Oregon employees, so those companies are responsible for 220 Oregon jobs with an Oregon payroll in 2008 alone of $28 million. Those payroll led to payroll taxes in 2008 alone of $1.8 million. So that $10 million investment, in addition to being an investment in a potentially high-growth, high-reward company, provided in 2008 alone nearly $2 million in tax revenues. And we've been in operation since 2002. To give you an example of some of those companies, I will mention three. Advanced Inquiry Systems is a company located in Hillsboro. They develop semiconductor test equipment, and their technology is regarded as so revolutionary that in addition to our investment and OVP investment, Intel, Applied Materials, and KLA-Tencor, so virtually three of the largest and most significant companies in the semiconductor industry, have also invested in Advanced Inquiry Systems. Another company is Perpetual Power Technologies. They're developing an energy-related technology that came out of the Pacific Northwest National Lab and technology from the University of Oregon. And they employ 12 people and are located in Corvallis. A final company is located in Tigard. That's Acrimed. We invested in Acrimed to help them expand their product offering and expand their market. Our $300,000 investment allowed them to do that. They were subsequently purchased for $25 million by iFlow, who maintains Acrimed here in Oregon as their research and product development arm. So the $300,000 that we invested yielded a 10x return. We returned $3 million to the fund from that one investment. So in addition to the job and economic creation, keep in mind we're investing primarily for return of capital purposes, and Acrimed is one example of an Oregon company that was able to generate the types of returns we're looking for. And with that, I'd be happy to take further questions, and thank you again for allowing me to speak with you this afternoon.
Now this is, thank you for giving us the specifics. This is high risk and high reward. So tell us, can you give us some idea of what your ratio is? For example, for all these success stories, how many just absolutely go belly up or fade out or take a long time? I mean, how do they break down?
Yeah, that's that is indeed the characteristic of our industry. And typical figures you'll look at is out of 10 investments, and the other speakers here can comment on this when they come up on their experience as well. But typically, of 10 investments, we'd expect one or two to yield really stellar performance, 5 to 10x return. We'd expect another three or four to yield perhaps a modest return, at least return of capital, perhaps something more. And the remainder, we would expect that either they never grow to the size that they could actually generate a return, so they'd stay in business but never give the investors opportunity to get their money back, or they would go out of business altogether.
But if they don't generate a return, they're still, you put into that category people who still have employees and are paying
still functioning companies. In the venture capital industry, we refer to these companies as zombies or the living dead. Colorful figure there, simply because from the investor's point of view, the investors have just endowed a company, but they're not getting a return from it.
Right. So basically you have one or two superstars out of 10, and then two or three more where you might get a
positive performers.
Positive return. And then the rest, which would be, you know, 5 to 7 of them would be zombies or go out of business.
Go out of business, yes.
Okay. And then how, with that kind of leverage, though, overall, with that kind of mix, if you could get 5 or 10-fold return on the first, on one or two, and two or three more being modest, and with the rest being zombies or going out of business, you would still see an overall return?
In fact, that is our strategy, that we look for high-growth companies that can turn into significant enterprises. That's also quite risky. So we require that the companies that succeed are successful enough that they not only pay for themselves, they make up for the ones that did not succeed.
Must be something that keeps you awake a lot at night.
In these economic times, access to capital is a very, very important factor. And so funds like the Oregon Growth Account that provide an indigenous local source of capital are quite critical to the companies we work with.
Now, tell us about the investment climate as you see it. I mean, it's a terrible economic climate overall, but I keep thinking of that Warren Buffett quote, you know, when everyone's greedy, be fearful. When everyone's fearful, be greedy. How does that apply to the venture capital world?
That's perhaps a larger question, which I can only touch on one aspect of it, and I would like the other folks who are going to testify today to provide their own perspective on it, because there are always going to be sectors that perform well no matter what the economic climate. We have a few companies in healthcare information technology. With the upcoming focus on improvements in healthcare, we would expect them to perform well. And one company that we have not invested in but is resides here in Oregon and is a has received venture funding from Oregon Growth Account related funds is Cryptic. We would expect them to perform well. We also invest in the life sciences sector. And typically those companies which are developing drugs and therapeutics would be not expected to provide products right for market for 5 to 6 years anyways. On the other hand, companies, one example is in the semiconductor development space. It's very hard right now to find capital for companies that are developing semiconductor chips because the end markets for products based on those are not performing very well. We're also seeing that venture funds are being very conservative with the funds they have to deploy, and they prefer or they are making sure that they have adequate funds to support the companies in their portfolio in the current economic environment until conditions improve.
I see. Support the ones they have rather than branch out.
Right.
Okay. Are there questions from the committee? We lost the stand here. Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to ask you about just the comments you made about the environment generally and the lack of capital. Do you see other companies turning to the growth account who might be seeking more traditional financing? Certainly it's been well publicized that it's very difficult for Oregon companies that are successful ones to get the capital they need to expand or in some cases just to continue with the business plan. So how do you see the current climate and the demand for these funds interplaying?
That's a good question, and I would answer that in two ways, Senator. First, having an indigenous source of capital is important because outside investors like to see that an investment opportunity has been validated by a professional investor, and much of venture capital is local. So if a local investor has invested in a company, that provides some level of validation, some level of credibility. That's also important because outside, and by outside I mean outside the state, investors would like to have, if they're making an investment that's not local for them, someone who is local to pay attention to it. So that is one benefit local investment provides. It's the local validation, and it's the ability to spend time with the company, the feet on the street. The other point, and this was made yesterday, the Oregon Angel Fund, which has received a commitment from the Oregon Growth Account, had its annual meeting yesterday, and they had 9 portfolio companies give a brief presentation and talk about what their company does. And I was impressed that every one of those companies commended the Oregon Angel Fund for being a source of capital local that would otherwise, it would be capital that would otherwise be unobtainable. They also commended the Oregon Angel Fund for doing very extensive diligence on the company to validate that it's a solid investment opportunity because they felt that that enabled further investment. So speaking from the point of view, simply hearing the companies talk about their own experiences, they, on a first-hand basis, emphasize the importance of having local capital.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, we'll put the last two up here together, Bill Campbell and Hugh Mackworth, maybe.
Mackworth.
Hugh, why don't you start?
Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Hugh Mackworth. I've been involved in high technology companies since the late 70s. I grew up in the Silicon Valley. I worked at Xerox Research Center. I worked at Apple when it was a startup. I worked at 3Com before it was public. and moved here in the early 90s because I saw an early set of capabilities here for doing innovative stuff in technology. My first job here was as the refounding CEO of Digimarc Corporation, and that particular company since gone public and has bought part of Polaroid and sold it again and so on is still operating here. But the it was an interesting experience for me because I had to visit with approximately, to get that company funded, I met with over 60 different venture funds, all of them in the Bay Area. So I became more and more familiar with the process and more intrigued by it. After Digimarc, I founded the Portland Angel Network, trying to create more of a community of investors of locally that would pay attention to the companies here. The Portland Angel Network is part of OEN, has since morphed into the Oregon Angel Fund. And then my partner, Debbie Coleman, and I started Smart Forest Ventures in 2000 to do hands-on local investing, early-stage seed investing here in Portland. Smart Forest Ventures would not have existed without the OGA. The OGA was our first commitment, and they invested $6 million in the fund. Altogether, we have the fund is $59 million, and about 85% of our investments have been here in Oregon. Last year alone, just going on the basis of the current portfolio, not including the companies that we have sold, there was $17 million, so that's $6 million of original investment. Last year, the portfolio that we have invested in here in Oregon, $17 million in wages, about $1.1 million last year in W-2 withholding for the state of Oregon. So I wanted to come and speak in favor of this of the OGA. It is a very important program, and in particular, I wanted to address one thing, which is the OGA is trying to hold two ideas in its head at the same time, and that can be difficult for any entity. It is simultaneously trying to create more of an infrastructure, create jobs, create new companies, create the virtuous cycle of that process of one company begetting another, being successful, creating another one. We don't have that flywheel running fully here in Oregon, and so more work is needed, and many people, including Bill Campbell here, who's been doing this for longer than I have in Oregon, has been involved in trying to create that flywheel. So that's one part of what OGA is trying to do, and the second part is trying to make a return on investment. Right. So the nice thing about the OGA is that it is managing to do a very positive impact on the state in terms of economic development without essentially costing the state anything at this point. Right. That the to date, my understanding is that the overall portfolio of the OGA has roughly broken even in terms of the current value, including the money that's been returned, is still at the same level as the original dollars in. In other words, the state hasn't paid anything here, and nonetheless, there have been 67 companies that have received investment. There have been, we've talked about some of these numbers already, 1,300 jobs related to those companies. Some of those jobs would have existed, some of those companies would have existed anyways, but many of them would not have. And the final point I'd like to make is on the importance of consistent investing. One of the reasons why the OGA and actually Smart Forest itself is not net positive in terms of our investments. One of the reasons is because we picked an unfortunate year to start. 2000 is the year that Smart Forest started. It's also the first year of OGA's investments. Not a good choice. Historically, if you look back, you know, if we knew now what we knew then, that would not have been the best year to start doing venture investing at the height of the bubble. So the OGA lost money in its initial period and has since been making money since then. The best time to invest is not at the peak of an investment cycle. The best time to invest is at the bottom of an investment cycle. You get the best terms, you get the best returns, and it can be the most productive. Similarly, on the economic development side, again, with the two hats that OGA wears, to keep in mind the economic impact and the wages and so on that can generate. Overall, Oregon is woefully deficient on investment capital, and the OGA has been a resounding success in both attracting the interest of outside investors coming to the state and in encouraging a local investment community. So I would urge you not to implement the holiday that has been suggested.
Thank you very much. Questions? So Smart Forest was actually started with OGA funds?
Correct. The very first presentation we made was to the OGA. It was getting rolling at that time, and it was the first presentation we made. And with their approval to go ahead, that then gave us the critical mass to start forming the rest of the fund. Mm-hmm. We now have 55 limited partners, mostly angels, about half here, half around the country, friends of ours, and colleagues from previous jobs, as well as Silicon Valley Bank, the IBM Corporation, et cetera.
Okay, thank you. Welcome.
My name is Bill Campbell. I'm a managing director with Equilibrium Capital. We formed it in the last couple of years. We are an investor in emergent leaders, mostly here in Oregon, based around a sustainability strategy. That's who I am today. As Hugh noted, my history in growth companies in Oregon goes back to the early 80s. And during most of that time, I served as their general counsel. I was chair of the Ader Wynn law firm from 2000 through 2005. And I've sat on a lot of boards of directors of both companies that wound up successful and companies that wound up unsuccessful. And frankly, it's the ones that were unsuccessful because they could not find the funding they needed that weigh on my soul every night when I go to bed. I think of the things that could have been that weren't able to be because we collectively didn't figure out how to solve this venture capital problem in the state of Oregon. I'm here today with both the greatest hope and the greatest fear I've had since I started my career in the early 80s. The greatest hope, because yesterday I sat in the Oregon Growth Account meeting and I heard under the leadership of Treasurer Westland and Deputy Miller a new strategy come out of the OGA board, which I believe for the first time gets it right, and I want to talk a little bit about that and what it means. I would love to spend time with all of you. I've worked with you in one way or another in different capacities, I think, from time to time, and with other members of the legislature. If you'd like to take my seminar on venture capital formation in the state of Oregon, I'd be delighted to give it. I will spare you that today because I'm deeply aware that I'm speaking here to the Revenue Committee and that you have a very, very difficult challenge ahead of you. And the challenge is that over the next biennium, you have to figure out how to keep this state running. And that means paying teachers, and it means paying the staff of this building, and it means paying the staff all throughout the rest of the state so that the critical services that keep us all going as a community work, and that is a non-trivial exercise. You do not have, and I recognize this very deeply, the luxury of thinking about lovely long-term strategies for building companies in this state right now. You are looking at how do we maximize revenue into our coffers so we can keep this state going. Now, you can't afford to not think about the long term as you do that, certainly, but I'm deeply aware that I'm speaking to the Revenue Committee. So I'd like to speak to this from the point of view of state tax collections. Going back to the arithmetic that Bill Newman described just a minute ago, and I completely agree with the arithmetic, Senator Burdick, you brought up an observation about that arithmetic, which I think bears a little bit more unfolding. And that is that all 10 of those companies, including the ones that ultimately don't make it, the ones that are zombies, the ones that have moderate success, and the ones that have enormous success, during the period they are working on making it, they are making payroll, and the payrolls are paying taxes. So every dollar that goes into one of these companies, most of that cash gets used for payroll. That's the biggest expense for any of these startup companies. It doesn't all go there, but most of it goes for payroll, and the payroll gets taxed, and that's revenue. So when you think about this model, you can't just think about what the returns are from the fund. You have to think about what the state revenues are being driven from the particular strategy being pursued. I want you to hold that thought with me for a bit as we look back at a little bit of the history here. The first cycle of Oregon's attempts to build a venture capital industry here, or additional venture capital behind Oregon companies that I'm familiar with, goes back to the Oregon, the ORTDC and the ORTDF. Wayne Embry and his partner John Ballou were managers of that. They did a very effective job. That fund, which was supposed to have $25 million, but which was only funded to half of that because the other half was supposed to come in a later legislature, and there was a big problem with the revenues at that period also, managed through an exclusive manager of those dollars alone, which is to say that the fund itself received no leverage from additional investors. It was only state dollars. So that fund was able to, as Wayne described, achieve enormous leverage in its investment in any number of companies in Oregon by pulling venture capital in across the border of the state behind the diligence and behind the development of the deals that it did to have the kind of results that Wayne described. So that's one kind of leverage, which I think of as deal leverage or syndicate leverage. And you heard Bill Newman describe that in his fund as well. The Northwest Technology Ventures is the heir of that portfolio and pursues a similar strategy. That is, Bill Newman and his partner Gordon Hoffman are primarily tasked with managing the state's own funds. So they do not get leverage into their own funds in the state. They're managing the state funds, but the leverage that he described is on the order of 15 to 1 in the deals. That is to say, for every dollar the state has put behind Northwest Tech Ventures, there's a leverage of about 15 to 1 into cash that comes into the state of Oregon. If you just do the arithmetic and you realize that the cash deployed over the course of 2 years mostly goes into payroll, you will realize that every dollar you put into Northwest Technology Ventures in the next biennium will come back with a return in the form of tax revenues to the state. You will be better off putting the money into Bill's fund and letting him put it into companies and drive that kind of leverage in this market than you will by taking the cash and putting it directly into the general fund. You'll actually get more revenues that way. Now, both the ORTDF and the Northwest Tech Ventures strategies allow leverage at the syndicate level. And by the way, that 15-to-1 ratio, we did a very deep study, John Miner and I, in 2004, based on 2004 data, of the kind of leverage that Oregon got from having funds under local management. And the answer was on about that level, about 15 to 1 from Oregon's local management funds. That's because Oregon is a very nascent venture capital state. It's got a lot of creativity, a lot of innovation potential, and it pulls a lot of capital across the border against very little local management. So that 15 to 1 is not an aberration. That's about what you expect from funds under management with managers located in the state of Oregon. Now, in addition to that leverage, if you add the leverage that happens with a fund that has a more general purpose category, so it's located here in Oregon like Hughes, what leverage do you bring in on top of a foundation investment from state capital like OGA, from other investors in the fund who say, well, if the people who know them best, their friends in the state, trust them with money, then we should too. And the answer is that for a very new fund, that's probably about a 3x to 4x. For a second or third generation fund, it's probably a 12 to 20x. So you're getting leverage in two places into Oregon funds by putting money into the new general purpose strategy that OGA has come up with to target focused on Oregon managers of new to market and growth funds in Oregon. With you're getting leverage at the fund level, so you're multiplying the funds by 3 to, if it's a later fund, 12x, and then you're getting it also at the deal leverage position where, based on the nascent statistics, it's 15x. The data we looked at said you get at least 5x even if it's in the growth area. The point here is that the dollars you put in here are going to get leveraged multiple times and going to pull in additional capital. When you think about the $83 million in payroll that's happening right now that described out of the existing OGA portfolio, that number in payroll terms is larger, I believe, than the total number of dollars currently invested out of OGA or the size of the current OGA fund or even the funds that have gone into OGA over its history. And what you're getting, if you think about that in terms of tax revenues back to the state, is a return of more than, what's our tax rate, 9%? Back into the state coffers from those investments, which is not a bad level of return. I think that the data is fairly compelling, and I can provide the assumptions and so on to legislative revenue staff or whoever else is appropriate, that leaving the dollars to work in OGA where they can get deployed immediately through investment managers in Oregon under OGA's new strategy will not only return more revenues to you in the state of Oregon for use in the next biennium where you have such a critical problem, but will also leave you in a position where that continues and multiplies in years ahead. I'd be happy again to share any of the underlying data with you at an appropriate moment.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Could you describe the new strategy as you see it, as it compared
yes.
to the old strategy?
Yes. The original strategy, what I would call the ORTDF strategy, is let's put money in Oregon companies. And so let's have an Oregon manager of Oregon dollars to put money exclusively into Oregon companies. And that allowed a substantial leverage. When OGA was formed, after Attorney General Myers figured out that we had a constitutional problem with the way that ORTDF was set up, when OGA was formed and put as a general fund within the general investment mandate of the Treasurer's Office, this difficulty that Mr. Mackworth alluded to of is it earnings or is it development took place. And the prior strategy of focusing through Oregon managers was essentially abandoned in favor of putting behind managers who had promised to put at least that much money in Oregon but were oftentimes located somewhere else. And that was, from the point of view of an investment manager, it made sense. If all you're trying to do is to maximize earnings and you had a mandate that said you had to put it in an emerging growth company, in emerging growth managers, you'd want to go find the most experienced one and just convince them to come look at Oregon. For a lot of reasons having to do with the dynamics of the venture capital industry, that doesn't work very well to build a venture capital industry in Oregon. And that's the seminar that I will spare you today. The new strategy says, let's recognize that the job of OGA is to build a venture capital industry in Oregon that can be self-perpetuating and self-driving behind Oregon companies. And it's very thoughtful and very, very much more deeply aware of the dynamics of the venture industry, including the reality that venture capitalists invest close to home. Any Silicon Valley venture capitalist will tell you they have something called the 20-minute rule. They will put most of their capital to work within 20 minutes of where they live. Those dynamics are now, under the new policy, going to be working for the state of Oregon and the Oregon Growth Account. I think personally that they will drive the revenue returns back to the state from the dollars that are now available to invest from the OGA by about the amount of that leverage that you get from being the local investor rather than the outside investor. So I think that whatever you think that ratio is, it's just 1-to-1 if you're investing down from Seattle, because you don't pull in any extra capital across. In fact, you're the capital that's getting pulled in across into Oregon. But if you're the local manager, you get that leverage. And in the most mature markets in the country, on average across the whole country, it's 3x. In a growth market, it's 5x, and in Oregon historically it's been 15x, and that's essentially the multiple that I think that Oregon's new strategy is driving for Oregon. Now, there's a lot of hard work that's going to happen behind that, and I was delighted to hear that in addition to just adopting a change in the investment strategy, OGA also adopted a decision about how that strategy would need a new style of management, because a lot of the managers in Oregon will be new. They will need some hands-on help. And the expectation that I heard from the treasurer yesterday is that there will be that hands-on help out of the treasurer's office in the form of an executive director who's focused on this particular fund. I think it's exactly the right strategy. It's exactly the business that everybody you've heard speak today the business model has come to over time, and it's something certainly that all of these friends of mine and I have talked about extensively, and I'm just delighted to hear that the treasurer's office has now adopted it.
Thank you very much. Questions? Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are the managing partners of these funds personally invested in the funds?
Well, we certainly are, Senator Morris. Our fund is not a recipient of OGA dollars today. We are an applicant for OGA dollars, so I should declare my self-interest in the outcome of this question to you. But we are absolutely investors of our own dollars in these funds. And we are investors of our own dollars not just in hard cash terms, but in sweat equity terms. Since the founding of this particular enterprise, I haven't yet taken a salary or a draw.
I'm sure I have several
questions. Did you want me to?
Please, continue.
Of the 16 funds that we're invested in, how many of those funds are the principals, owners of those funds, also invested in these ventures?
I think it's probably true that all of them are, because that's generally a requirement that limited partners have, but I don't know that. I haven't studied that. I'm not the manager of those funds. Perhaps Mr. Miller could answer it. Is that generally something you see? Yeah.
Yeah, with Smart Forest, the OGA has a $6 million investment. Debbie and myself have a $3 million investment in the fund.
What is the fund, typically the fund management fees that are charged to these ventures?
I think there's two different levels of question about that. One is, what's the management fees typically charged to one of these things? It depends a little bit on the size of the fund. For a smaller fund, 2.5% annual fee on the total committed capital is usually about the level. If you think about a fund of modest size, $80 million, let's say, that would drive a budget that fund could use to manage that capital over the lifetime of the management contract. Of $2 million, typically that number decline, an annual budget of $2 million, that would be used to pay the principals of the manager, as well as the investment staff of the manager, as well as the diligence work, as well as a lot of other work like that. It's for a smaller fund, it would ratchet down, but that would be a classic payment mechanism. Of course, before the managers of that fund realize any upside benefit, that management fee effectively has to be paid back. That is, one hears of carry returns back to managers and so on. I think in the venture industry, there's a certain mythological quality that at this point is attached to carry returns. I don't think anybody's seen carry returns in about 10 years. But in terms of the investors themselves, before the managers start participating in some percentage of the upside, the investors would have received all of their invested capital back, including the portion that went to the management fees. In our fund, I can tell you that the bulk of the management fees that we received to date have gone to staff and employees who are not managing directors of the fund. In fact, my partner and I have yet to, as I said, take a salary of any kind out of it. We think our job is to drive returns for the investors, and we think that we should participate when that starts happening.
Lots of questions, lots of issues here.
Quite right.
Well, the concept of public funds accruing to the benefit of the investing managing partner, it raises a lot of red flags, and I'm not sure that we've thoughtfully looked at those kinds of potential conflicts in this whole management scheme. And my question would be, when was the last time we had a Secretary of State audit of OGA?
Maybe the Treasurer would.
Certainly not on my watch, but find out.
Well, and Madam Chair, I don't raise that in the context of.
We
have to bring you up if you're going to talk.
I don't raise that in the context of. You know, something doesn't look right. But the general structure of funds being public monies going into private enterprise for the benefit of those managing partners, just the principle of that, I think it gives me pause.
Senator Morse, if anything we've said suggests that we would expect public funds to come in for the benefit of the managing partners, I would hope that that notion is viewed properly as inappropriate. When the state hires a road crew, it hires a private company that expects to make a profit. You could consider that road crew is building the road, therefore, for the benefit of the owners of that private company, and that the profit they make seems somehow inappropriate, but it's not generally viewed that way. I think that when the state hires a manager of monies in something like this to generate a return, that there is an expectation that it should be a contract in that same way. There is a job. It's our job to do for any of our investors, and that's to drive a return for them. Out of that, there's a budget for what it takes to do that, and that budget requires that we pay enough so that we can pay our mortgages and our groceries and so on, just like the guys who work the road crew or the guys who manage the guys who work the road crew do. If at the end of the day we can drive a profit from that, that's all to the good. It allows us to reinvest. That profit should be reasonable. It should be appropriate. There's a well-known market for what is reasonable and appropriate, and we want to be entirely and completely transparent about what's appropriate. appropriate in that. But one of the things that has troubled me long before I ever came onto this side of the industry is there has been a perception that those who are in the business of managing money effectively to drive returns for investors and to drive policy for the state of Oregon are somehow viewed as an inappropriate recipient of funds, that the businesses that we are running are not businesses themselves. I can tell you, I'm an Oregon business, and I have Oregon employees, and I have Oregon payroll, and the work I'm doing benefits this community. If it doesn't do that, and if I'm not prepared to stand up and show you why it does that and why I'm a worthy contractor for the state and the state funds, I don't deserve your consideration as a recipient of the funds. But we're not here looking for something for our benefit. If it doesn't make sense to you that's a benefit to the people of Oregon, we don't belong here.
And more broadly, all investment funds have that structure, that there is some, that you manage in a fiduciary sense those funds for the benefit of the investor, but there is some payment that is made for that. For example, all of the OIC investments that are placed with managers, those managers are paid some percentage per year of the dollars that are being managed. So,
Madam Chair,
Senator Morris.
I draw the distinction between a fee for service provided and equity in an enterprise, public funds and private funds of the fund managers. And maybe I'm not understanding your model, but if you have a fund and you have $5 million coming from the state, you put in $3 million of your own, and you have outside investors that, say, put in another $50 million. And you all together are formed in an equity arrangement. I question the appropriateness of that because of the pecuniary benefit that you get personally because of the public's participation.
Which part of the pecuniary benefit is troubling? I just want to make sure I understand where the concern is.
Well, I'm concerned from the public's perspective that these monies would be going to the benefit of the investing managing partners in a business enterprise.
How do you mean benefit those, Senator? I don't mean to be challenging. I'm just really trying to understand how this is different than the salary that the road crew pays to its president, CEO, owner, and when it builds a road.
Or a mutual fund.
You picked a very good example because that was my business.
Good.
We didn't own the road.
No.
We provided a service, a product. We're paid for that, but we didn't have an ownership in it. And it was truly an arm's-length transaction. And we're getting into somewhat of an area here that probably is gray. I don't have the benefit of maybe full understanding of how these things work. But I do raise this issue because we are under a very, very strong microscope. And in terms of our own statement of economic interests and how we relate to the state and public monies that we can never have, without a full disclosure, a pecuniary benefit because of our relationship. And there are just some troubling issues here, Madam Chair. And I
can I ask for clarification? So, for example, the Oregon Investment Council might put money at Vanguard to be run by an investment manager there and for the benefit of that fund, and they would be paid a certain amount. So what is, and Vanguard itself would then be buying equities in public companies in that case. What is different, why is this troubling to you and that would not be? Just a mutual fund that the state would invest in?
And you raise a valid point. I need to understand more about how these things are structured. But
I'd be delighted to have those conversations.
We are always happy to explain
further with you. I don't think it's appropriate to pay us any more than fairly, and in any other way than a way that the state thinks will drive its maximum benefit. And going back to your experience as a road contractor, It is true that you didn't own the road. Mostly, as a manager of these funds, we don't own the road either. We're investing money behind the need to build the road, but it's owned by the limited partnership. We may own a piece of the limited partnership, but we don't get any return on the limited partnership interest. It's any different from any of the other limited partners with respect to the particular funds that they have put in. Mostly, the investors in a fund view it as a positive to have our money mixed in with that because they feel like we have something at risk. And in fact, they like a bigger number rather than a littler number. And that's a philosophy of how you manage investment managers, I would think. The fees that we get paid to manage the monies are essentially akin, I would say, to the contract price for building the road. They're just a certain amount that you have to pay, and at the end of it, you have a road, and the road is owned by the state. Well, at the end of it, you have a portfolio, and the portfolio is owned by the state and by the limited partners and the fund generally, and the fees are there. And the owners of the road fund, just like the owners of the management company, receive an appropriate salary for that. But there's also an incentive at the end. And the incentive is, if you finish the road early, we're going to give you a bonus. And into the investment manager structure, there's the concept that if you actually generate positive returns, you get to share in a piece of those positive returns. That doesn't happen if the returns aren't positive, and that's what's referred to as the carry. So different parts of the investment industry certainly have different ways of constructing that bonus, but it's generally thought that it's a good thing to have a bonus in there to encourage the managers to understand that they're not just pushing paper around, but that driving returns is extremely useful and important. I think that structure generally is sensible, but the specific arithmetic of it, how it's managed so that the fiduciary responsibility is kept and so on is something that obviously we're happy to share with the committee at great length.
Thank you. I have a feeling you may be back at some point.
Well, happy to, and any help we can be.
Senator Morris, do you have any more questions?
Oh, Madam Chair, I apologize for taking up the panel's time here, and I'm sure it's obvious, I just don't understand it. If we've invested a total of $21.2 million, and we have current commitments of 92.4. What's the status of the other approximately 19 million?
I'll have to leave that to the treasurer's office.
We're going to bring back the treasurer. So before this panel leaves, anybody else have any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think we got a mini seminar. Thank you. Okay, I'd like to invite our treasurer back up to conclude this. If you have any parting thoughts or could answer the question that did come up, which is who, if anybody, does oversight? How does the oversight function work? And are you covered by the Secretary of State's audit provisions?
Let me...
Would you identify yourself one more time?
For the record, Treasurer Ben Westland. Let me let Mr. Mueller identify himself and cover the last audit function that was performed, which I believe was internal. But
thank you. Mike Mueller, Deputy Chief Investment Officer. We, in fact, just received a draft audit report from our internal audit group related to what they've termed smaller accounts. So by their definition, anything smaller than the Oregon Public Employees Retirement Fund is smaller, so it covered a lot of the other accounts that we do, including the Oregon Growth account. It's still in draft form. We have a meeting with them on Monday morning. I've read the draft, and they had no concerns related to the Oregon Growth account, so no findings of note. I'd have to check with them in terms of the Secretary of State's Audits Division if they've performed any work historically on the Oregon Growth account. All of the underlying partnerships are audited annually. As the gentleman pointed out, we consider it an alignment of interest. We want them to have more money involved. Certainly, if they are losing State of Oregon money and an investment gone bad, we want them to feel that pain equally. If they have $1 million alongside our $6 million and it goes to zero, we're not happy about it. But there's comfort in knowing that they had a fiduciary responsibility to us and to themselves that they lost $1 million as well. Were we just to pay a fee for service and they lost the state $6 million and we paid them a management fee on top of it, I'd be more concerned about that situation than I would that they're investing alongside us. So hopefully that addresses a bit of your concern.
And just generally with regard to the fee issue, first of all, these are statutorily covered in the basic Oregon Growth Account Statute 348.702. And we don't make these up. It's not like something we pull something out of the air. I mean, these have been established. They're market-driven, you know, established by the free market enterprise over decades. So these aren't some number we just happen to feel good about on any given morning or those managers happen to feel good about. The other point, not to belabor this, but I thought Mr. Campbell's comments with regard to a very large corpus of money, the Oregon Public Employees Retirement Fund, covered by very much of the same structure, you know, to participate in these markets, to participate in these growth opportunities, we participate in a structure created by private enterprise. And it mirrors exactly what goes on, and specifically, Senator Morris, if you know, you or I, in fact, actually, we pay lower fees because of the size of our corpus. But if you or I were to go invest in a real estate limited partnership or capitalization in U.S. equities, global equities, bond funds, they're the same fees. And that's for the benefit of the state of Oregon. So those are my comments with regard to it. We'd be happy to get you any documentation, historic fees, anything you require.
Thank you very much. It's been a very interesting conversation. Are there any questions from the committee now that the treasurer is back? We will continue this conversation, and we will use this relating clause in some way that will be to the benefit of the state of Oregon and all of its people.
I am very much in support of the relating to clause, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Burdick, one final question. I think Senator Morse had a question about a particular number. If I... Were you able to answer that on your own? Or?
If I may, Madam Chair.
Please.
On the summary that was provided to us by Legislative Revenue, or by your office, it indicates a total investment of $121.2 million, but you have commitment current of $92.4 million. Could you explain the delta?
Chair Burdick, Senator Morse, I'd be happy to. The $121.2 million includes the additional money that came from outside the state or from additional investors other than the OGA. The number, the $46.3 million, is the actual portion of the $121.2 that is specifically Oregon Growth Account money. But that $121 includes money that comes from investors outside the OGA. That's why it's much larger than the commitment amount by the Oregon Growth Account Board.
So the $46.3 million, that's the sum total of all the OGA investment since the account was formed?
Correct.
Okay.
On a $92 million commitment level, as we've discussed previously, that's the amount that's been drawn down so far.
Okay. Got it. Okay.
Okay.
Not exactly, but let's move on.
Well, I think the other half, I don't know if it's on that sheet, the other half of that is there is money that has been contractually committed.
That's here.
That's 46.1 that's been placed with specific managers and companies that has, quote, not been invested. And this is the last thing we or the investment division, the Public Employees Retirement Fund, you know, want to be in a hurry or give direction of, gee, invest this money now, just go out and find deals. No, go out and find the best deals.
So basically, the $92.4 million, which is 46.3 plus 46.1, the $92.4 million is how much you've gotten from your share of the lottery funds since it started, plus interest. Where does that come from? Does the other $46.1 million exist now?
Senator Burdick, Chair Burdick, it does exist. We have cash in the Oregon Short-Term Fund to cover those remaining commitments that have been made.
So basically you've gotten $92.4 million from the lottery over the life of the OGA.
Chair Burdick, I think the number's actually $97 million. I'd be happy to share that reconciliation with you, because remember, we've gotten back $18 million. We've gotten money from the lottery, and there's commitments that have gone out. So when you do the whole reconciliation, I think the number is $97 million.
Yeah, I'd like to see a breakdown of how much money you got, what's committed, what's already been, what's waiting to be committed, and just see a breakdown put in that way. Would that answer your question, Senator
Thank
Morris?
Thank you.
Senator Telford.
Well, because now I'm confused, because what I did was convert your column to 92.4 minus 46.3, put a line under it and said that's 46.1 remaining to be called, 18 going to be distributed, which leaves 23. So now you're telling me there's another $5 million, and I don't see how that factors into this mathematical.
Well, I think we're just going to stop, and we're going to give them a chance to provide the full. Because I think people are just kind of
looking at it. Yeah, Chair Burdick, I'd be happy to do that. Yeah. The problem is a lot of these numbers are mutually exclusive. So when you try to do the reconciliation that you're talking about, it's going to get mixed up. I'll put it in one format, and
great,
we'll tie them all out.
And we'll look forward to seeing that. And we are adjourned.